Welcome back, everybody, to another deep dive. Today we're going to be taking a look at Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 19, and we're joined again by our expert to help us break this down. This is a really interesting passage, I think, because it kind of explodes with theological dynamite. It's not just about a healing, it's about these power struggles, shocking alliances, and, you know, even Jesus setting the stage for a whole new kind of community. So
yeah, and what's fascinating is how it picks up right where that controversy in Mark chapter 2 left off. I mean, the tension from that whole Sabbath showdown is practically buzzing in the air, right? I mean, we're back in the synagogue, and you can almost feel those Pharisees just like boring into Jesus, waiting for him to slip up.
Right, like, okay, miracle worker, let's see what you've got this time. And then, boom, a man with a shriveled hand walks in. Now, I've always wondered, was this just a coincidence? Or was there something a little bit more deliberate going on?
You know, I think Mark is very intentionally setting the scene here. Remember, he's writing for an audience who totally understands the nuances of Jewish law and that just simmering conflict between Jesus and the religious establishment. This isn't just some random guy who needs healing. He's a pawn in this much larger power struggle.
So Jesus sees this man, and instead of just quietly healing him like he's done in other situations, he calls him forward, right into the center of the room. It's like he's saying, all right, Pharisees, you want a show? Let's give you one.
Exactly. And then he throws down this question that just slices through all their legal arguments. Mm-hmm. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? And, you know, it's brilliant. He's not asking for like a theological debate. He's forcing them to confront the heart of the matter.
And they can't answer. I mean, their silence is deafening. What are they supposed to say? Well, yes, it's okay to kill on the Sabbath, but healing? That's a big no-no.
Right. Their silence speaks volumes about their priorities. They're so fixated on rules and traditions that they've completely lost sight of compassion and just basic human decency. And this is where it gets really interesting, because Mark tells us that Jesus was angry and deeply distressed by their response.
Angry from Jesus. That's not an emotion we see very often in the Gospels. It makes you realize how high the stakes really are here.
Yeah, it's not just irritation. It's a deep grief over their spiritual blindness. And this whole scene foreshadows those even greater confrontations that are to come. And it hints at the ultimate consequences of rejecting God's grace. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes you wonder if we ever get so caught up in our own rightness that we miss opportunities to show compassion and to extend grace to other people.
It's definitely a gut check moment.
Yeah.
And then to drive his point home even further, Jesus heals the man right there in front of them. Talk about a mic drop moment. But instead of softening their hearts, it pushes the Pharisees over the edge. They go from being annoyed to downright murderous.
Yeah, and here's where we see just how threatened they are by Jesus, because they team up with the Herodians to plot against him, their political rivals. I mean, that's like Democrats and Republicans joining forces to take down a common enemy. It just shows you how much Jesus was disrupting the established order.
The Herodians, they always seemed like a shadowy group to me. Who were they, exactly?
They were essentially pro-Roman political operatives, often working behind the scenes to maintain Roman influence in Judea. They usually clashed with the Pharisees, who resented Roman rule. But the threat Jesus posed was so great that they were willing to put aside their differences just to eliminate him.
That's a chilling thought. And it kind of sets the stage for the rest of the gospel, this escalating conflict between Jesus and the powers that be. But amidst all this tension, we see Jesus's fame just spreading like wildfire. Mark describes these huge crowds coming from all over Galilee and even beyond to see him. What was it about Jesus that drew these crowds?
Well, I think it was a combination of factors. Yep. I mean, there was the undeniable power of his miracles, of course. But there was also something about his message, his authority, his compassion that resonated deeply with people who were hungry for something more than what the religious establishment was offering. They saw in Jesus a genuine connection to God, a hope for something better.
It's fascinating to me how even the demons recognize Jesus' authority. They're crying out, "You are the Son of God," but Jesus consistently silences them. Why do you think that was? It seems like that kind of supernatural endorsement would have been really powerful.
I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the different sources of authority. Jesus didn't want his identity or his mission to be validated by forces that were opposed to God. He knew who he was, and he didn't need demonic confirmation. It's a subtle point, but it reveals a lot about Jesus' understanding of his own power and purpose.
So we've got rising tensions, massive crowds, and even demonic recognition of Jesus' power. And then in the midst of all this chaos, Jesus makes this pivotal move. He chooses his 12 apostles.
This is a crucial moment in Mark's gospel. It's not just about forming a close-knit group of followers. It's about establishing a new kind of community, one that will carry on his mission after he's gone.
Amidst all this, we're only about halfway through this passage. What happens next?
Well, this is where things get even more intense, because we're about to meet the 12, and let me tell you, they're a fascinating bunch.
Okay, I'm on the edge of my seat. Let's dive into part two and meet these apostles.
So picking these 12 apostles is a very deliberate act, especially in the context of Jewish history. I mean, it's almost like Jesus is saying, look, I'm not just here to like tweak the system. I'm here to establish a whole new order.
Right. We can't forget that, you know, those listening to Mark's gospel for the first time would have instantly caught this parallel to the 12 tribes of Israel. It would have been a huge statement, almost revolutionary.
Exactly. It's like he's creating this new Israel, a new chosen people. And get this, he doesn't include himself as one of the 12. Which I think reinforces this idea that he stands in the position of God forming his chosen people, similar to how God chose the 12 tribes of Israel.
It's mind-blowing when you think about the implications. These 12 ordinary guys, fishermen, tax collectors, you name it, are being invited to be part of something truly groundbreaking.
Yeah, it's almost as if Jesus is handpicking people from the fringes of society, those overlooked by the religious elite. And he's building this movement from the ground up with those who are hungry for change and open to this new way of seeing the world.
And they're not just passive followers, are they? I mean, they're given real power and authority. They're sent out to preach, cast out demons. It's like Jesus is extending his own ministry through them. It makes me think of a wildfire spreading across a dry field.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember that, you know, Mark doesn't explicitly mention the apostles being given the power to heal at this point, even though we know from later in the gospel that they did heal. So it's fascinating how that authority to preach and cast out demons seems to imply the ability to heal as well.
That's a great observation. So we know their purpose, but who are these guys? Dr. Jennings mentioned some interesting things about the actual list of names. For example, why is Simon Peter always listed first?
It's not just random, that's for sure. Peter consistently takes this leadership role throughout the Gospels. He's often the spokesperson for the group, the one who asks the tough questions, and sometimes puts his foot in his mouth. But Jesus clearly sees something special in him, a boldness and a potential for growth that kind of sets him apart.
Then you've got James and John, the sons of thunder. Now, that's a nickname that definitely piques my curiosity. It makes me think of fire and brimstone sermons and maybe even a few heated arguments with the Pharisees.
Huh. I love it. It suggests certain intensity, a passionate zeal for Jesus and his message. And as we'll see later in Mark, they weren't afraid to speak their minds, even if it got them into trouble.
And of course, there's the elephant in the room, or should I say the betrayer in the boat, Judas Iscariot. It always strikes me as odd that Mark includes him in the list, knowing full well how the story ends.
Right. Why not just leave him out? I mean, it wouldn't change the overall narrative, but I think it speaks to the authenticity of Mark's account. It would be so easy to create a story where all the disciples are perfectly loyal and devoted to Jesus, but real life is messy, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the fact that Judas is from Judea, unlike the other 11 who are from Galilee, adds another layer of complexity.
Oh, you're right. It highlights the diversity within the group. You have these Galileans who are united by their region and experiences, and then you have Judas, the outsider, with potentially different motivations and loyalties. And even with this incredibly diverse group, their first job isn't about doing anything spectacular. It's about being with Jesus.
You're right. Before sending them out to preach or heal or cast out demons, Jesus calls them simply to accompany him, to learn from him, to soak in his way of being in the world. It makes me think of like an apprenticeship. They're learning the trade, so to speak, by being in close proximity to the master craftsman.
That's such a profound point. It really highlights the importance of relationship and discipleship. It's not just about acquiring knowledge or mastering techniques. It's about being transformed by the presence of Jesus, allowing his way of life to shape your own.
So it's less about what they're doing and more about who they're becoming.
Precisely. It's about developing a deep, intimate connection with Jesus that permeates every aspect of their being. And then once they've spent time with him, once they've been formed by his presence, then they're empowered to go out and extend his ministry to become conduits of his grace and power.
This idea of simply being with Jesus before doing for Jesus is so powerful. It challenges me to think about my own faith journey. Mm-hmm. Am I spending enough time just sitting at the feet of Jesus, listening to his teachings, allowing his love to transform me from the inside out?
That's a great question to reflect on. It's so easy to get caught up in the busyness of ministry to focus on checking things off our to-do lists. But true discipleship starts with a deep, abiding relationship with Jesus.
That's a fantastic takeaway. And speaking of takeaways, this passage in Mark is packed with them. We've covered the escalating conflict with the Pharisees, the explosive growth of Jesus' movement, the strategic choice of the 12 apostles. It feels like things are reaching a boiling point. So where do we go from here? What happens next in Mark 3?
Well, the scene shifts again. Jesus is at a house, and the crowds are so thick that he and his disciples can't even grab a bite to eat. This is where we see another layer of conflict emerge, one that hits close to home for Jesus.
Close to home, you mean like family drama?
Exactly. Yeah. Even Jesus' own family is starting to get worried. They hear about all the commotion, the healings, the controversy, and they think he's gone off the deep end. They want to take him home to protect him, or maybe even to silence him.
Wow, that must have stung. To have your own family think you're out of your mind, to not understand your mission.
It's a really poignant moment. And it raises this deeper question. Who truly belongs to Jesus? Who are his true followers? Is it about blood ties? Or is it about a shared commitment to his mission?
That's such a thought-provoking question. And then, as if things weren't tense enough, the religious leaders show up ready to pour gasoline on the fire.
They accuse Jesus of using demonic power to cast out demons, which is just mind-boggling when you think about it. It's like they're so blinded by their opposition to Jesus that they can't even acknowledge the obvious good that's happening.
It's like a classic case of attributing God's work to the devil. They can't deny the miracles, so they try to discredit them by associating them with evil. But then Jesus responds with one of the most powerful and perhaps most unsettling passages in the entire gospel.
You're talking about his warning about blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Truly, I tell you, people can be forgiven all their sins and every slander they utter. But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit will never be forgiven. They are guilty of an eternal sin. Those words are intense. It's like a spiritual line in the sand. But what exactly does it mean to blaspheme against the Holy Spirit?
It's a weighty question, and it's been interpreted in so many various ways throughout history. But I think at its core, it refers to this deliberate and persistent rejection of God's grace, even when it's staring you right in the face. It's a hardening of the heart, a choosing of darkness over light, even when the light is shining so brightly.
So it's not just a one-time slip of the tongue or a fleeting moment of doubt. It's about a continual conscious turning away from God.
Exactly. It's about refusing to acknowledge the work of God, even when it's undeniable. It's like looking directly at the sun and claiming it's dark.
I have to admit, this passage has always been a bit unsettling to me. It makes you wonder, have I ever crossed that line? Have I ever hardened my heart so much that I've become unforgivable? How can you even know?
Those are difficult questions, and I don't think there's an easy answer. But I find it comforting to remember that the very fact that we're concerned about this, that we're wrestling with these questions, shows that the Holy Spirit is still at work in us. It's the people who aren't even bothered by the idea of blasphemy, the people who are completely indifferent to God's grace who should be worried.
That's a really helpful perspective. I mean, the Pharisees, for example, were so convinced of their own righteousness, so blinded by their own interpretations of the law, that they couldn't even see the work of God happening right in front of them.
You're exactly right. And that's the tragedy of it all. They were so focused on being right, on maintaining their power and control, that they missed out on the very thing they claimed to be seeking, God's presence and favor.
It's ironic, isn't it? Their pursuit of righteousness actually led them further away from God.
It's a reminder that humility and a willingness to change our minds are essential for spiritual growth. We have to be open to the possibility that we might be wrong, that our interpretations might be flawed, that God might be doing something new and unexpected that challenges our preconceived notions.
So what does it look like to have a soft heart, a heart that's open to the Holy Spirit, even when it challenges our comfort zones?
I think it starts with being honest with ourselves about our own limitations, about our tendency to cling to our own rightness. It's about being willing to let go of control, to surrender to God's will, even when it doesn't make sense to us.
It's about being teachable, being willing to learn and grow, even if it means admitting we were wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about embracing the mystery of God, acknowledging that his ways are often higher than our ways, and trusting that he is working all things together for good, even when we can't see the bigger picture. So we were just discussing how Jesus calls his disciples to simply be with him before sending them out to do the work of ministry.
It's such a powerful image, isn't it? It reminds me that discipleship isn't just about checking things off a to-do list. It's about cultivating this deep, intimate relationship with Jesus.
Absolutely. And Dr. Jennings makes this fascinating connection between this call to be with Jesus and the formation of a new kind of family. Remember how Jesus' own family shows up trying to pull him away from the crowds, even suggesting that he's out of his mind?
Yeah, talk about awkward family dinners. I can't imagine what that must have been like for Jesus to have his own family doubt his mission and question his sanity.
is a really poignant moment. And I think it highlights this fundamental shift that's happening in Jesus's ministry. He's establishing this new set of priorities, this new understanding of family that goes beyond blood ties and cultural expectations.
So it's not about rejecting your biological family, but about recognizing that true belonging is found in this community of disciples who are united by their shared commitment to Jesus and his mission.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this new family is built on a foundation of radical love, acceptance, and forgiveness. Even when it's hard, even when it's messy, it's a community where those who have been marginalized and rejected by society can find belonging and purpose.
It's a beautiful vision, and it challenges me to think about the ways I prioritize my own relationships. Am I investing in communities that embody this kind of radical love and inclusivity? Am I willing to step outside my comfort zone and welcome those who are different from me?
Those are great questions to ask ourselves. And I think this passage in Mark challenges us to expand our understanding of what it means to be family. It's not just about those who share our DNA or our last name. It's about those who share our commitment to the teachings of Jesus and who are willing to walk alongside us on this journey of faith, supporting us, challenging us, and loving us unconditionally.
This has been such a rich and insightful deep dive into Mark 3, 1 through 19. I feel like we've uncovered layers of meaning that I never even knew existed.
Me too. And I think Dr. Jennings would be thrilled to know that his lecture notes sparked such a fascinating conversation.
I have a feeling he would have a lot more to add to this discussion. But for now, let's recap some of the key takeaways from this passage.
Sure. We started by talking about that intense power struggle between Jesus and the religious authorities, how even a simple act of healing on the Sabbath became this flashpoint for controversy.
And we saw how Jesus' response to their opposition revealed a deep grief over their spiritual blindness, a righteous anger that's rarely depicted in the Gospels.
We explored the shocking alliance between the Pharisees and the Herodians, highlighting the extreme threat that Jesus posed to the established order, both religious and political.
We dove into the significance of Jesus choosing his 12 apostles, recognizing the parallels to the 12 tribes of Israel and the formation of a new kind of community centered on Jesus and his teachings.
We unpacked the challenge of blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, emphasizing the danger of hardening our hearts against God's grace and the importance of cultivating a posture of humility and teachability.
And we landed on this beautiful vision of a new kind of family, one that transcends biological ties and cultural expectations, embracing radical love, acceptance, and forgiveness.
It's a powerful reminder that the gospel is not just about individual salvation. It's about transforming our relationships, our communities, and ultimately the world around us.
Wow, what an incredible journey. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 19. I hope it sparked some new insights and challenged you to think about your own faith journey in a fresh way.
And I hope it encourages you to keep digging deeper into the scriptures, to keep asking tough questions, and to keep seeking the heart of God in everything you do.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep.